I'm Eric Zelo.
I'm Arthur Anderson.
And this past semester, we had an opportunity to do something really cool.
We had the chance to team teach a class with a bunch of students and get them out in the field doing some archaeology, get them down in the archives, doing some hands-on history, and explore a part of the history of our campus that had pretty well been forgotten, and something that even we were unaware of.
Yeah, it all began when I saw a picture, a photograph of what's now our main academic and administrative building, DeCary Hall. And there was this house in front of it, a house that's not there anymore. Now there's a kneeling statue. What was this house? Where did it come from? Who built it? What's the story? And so the idea for the class was, well, we'll find out. And in the process of that, we can explore what history is, what archaeology is, how they differ, where they overlap.
They complement each other, how they work together, or how they conflict sometimes. What do we prioritize if we have different pieces of information from different sources, from different disciplines? All in ways that we hoped could be exciting for students.
And the thing was, it seems to have been. It was really incredible. We had pretty good enthusiasm right from the start. Then we got out to do the archaeological dig, and it was incredible. People just kind of fell into their roles. We were all sort of learning how to do archaeology, getting really excited about the funniest little things coming out of the ground. Oh my God, we found a rock. And then we found a clamshell, and then we found, and it was so cool. And then that enthusiasm kind of carried on into the archives and carried on to doing some interviews with people and ultimately into the podcasts.
One of the things that I had the most fun with is that even though I'm used to introducing students to archaeology and making them a part of my research, bringing students in the field, that's primarily bringing students out to be a part of research that's been ongoing. And it's great when they find their niche and they take an active role in that and they become a part of it. But in a sense, it's also my research that they're participating in. Being a part of this project, where 20th century archaeology is pretty new to me as an archaeologist, being out there with students where we are all figuring this out as we go along. They were doing historical research that was changing what we were doing in the ground every day, and sometimes they were just doing that on their own time in the evening. So it really was something that we all explored together as students and faculty in a new way.
Yeah, it was kind of a learning experience in terms of how to put the class together, in terms of how to time things. The podcast, the final projects, really couldn't start to take shape until almost the last minute, because we didn't know what the story was until the last minute.
And we had some big changes.
And yeah, I mean, one of the things that was striking to me was how often the plot seemed to change. I'm used to having, as a historian, I'm used to having a hypothesis or a question. I'm used to going into the archives, and it sort of reveals itself. And I don't usually find that after I've looked at a few things, I'm completely getting turned around and everything I thought I knew was wrong. And that seemed to happen every day in archaeology. I don't know how you can handle the excitement.
you let it wash over you. You get used to it. But yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to the ways in which sometimes coming into an archaeological site that we don't know things about, the questions that we have are so big and anything could happen. But I'm also astonished by the level of detail that we're able to get about people's lives from the historical records that we come onto, and how much detail we're able to get when we do get answers. So that, on the other end of the spectrum, that was new and different for me.
Yeah. And of course, you know, at the end too, we're throwing students into doing podcasts when they hadn't done that before too. So this was a class about a lot of energy and excitement right from the start, and a learning curve that was relentlessly upwards.
Yeah.
For every one of us.
For all of us, yeah.
And I don't know, it was fun to come in every Wednesday for this class, and I think that you'll get some of that in the podcasts. in the four episodes of podcasts that we're going to have for you here. The first episode of the Digging the Wayside podcast, we went through a few different titles for this. The first episode picks up the story of this area, which turns out to be an incredibly interesting and important region and place right here where our campus exists, the University of New England, picks up the story really with the last ice age.
Yeah, students start with the last ice age and give us a pretty quick run through to the beginning, I think, of the industrial era, which really started to reshape Biddeford from a place where the area of our campus, out by what's now Biddeford Pool, was kind of considered the heart of the town, versus a shift towards the falls and a shift towards the mill buildings and associated cultural, social, religious, and economic shifts that really, I think, kind of set the stage for the story of the house and the family that we'll be talking about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of surprises to me, I've been at UNE now for a little over 16 years, and I never really thought much about it, right? It's a very pretty campus. But I didn't think so much, even though I'm a historian, about the sort of time depth here. But this is a place that's been inhabited, and Arthur, your work has really expanded on what we know about this. It's been inhabited since essentially the end of the last ice age. It goes through a vibrant history with native peoples here, and then it becomes one of the first points of contact with European colonizers. It becomes one of the first places that's mapped. It becomes one of the first places that's settled before, it turns out, Plymouth. And then the sort of stories that develop from there are really astonishing, and they say a lot about our country. They say a lot about Maine. They say a lot also about world history, to be honest. So that's pretty exciting stuff. And I think that you'll pick some of that up in this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to think about the area that's now our campus as a microcosm for a lot of things going on in the last few hundred years. And my work on our campus, I'm primarily a prehistoric archaeologist, and I've done some excavations and worked with the prehistoric site on campus, and we have ancestors of the Wabanaki, again, going back to the end of the last ice age here in York County, and certainly several thousand years here in areas of our campus itself. And as I've been working with that archaeology, there's always been encounters with some of the 20th century archaeology, be that the Boy Scout camps or fishing or any number of other things that were occurring here. And the chance to learn more about that has been really interesting and really impactful.
Do you believe in ghosts? There's this lore on UNE's campus. You might have heard of it. Dakari is haunted. And while I do sometimes feel like the life's getting sucked out of me while I'm walking up those stairs, I'm not sure if that necessarily means there's a ghost. But it's not all that surprising that ghost stories have popped up in this area when you learn about the history. Do I actually think Dakari is haunted? No. But if there was going to be a place that is haunted, it might as well be on UNE's campus. Why? Well, people have been on this land for thousands, and I mean thousands of years. If there was such a thing as right conditions for a land being haunted, it would be here. Let us tell you why. Hey guys, I'm Olivia Ellis.
I'm Lucas Gerard.
And I'm Peyton Stevens.
And welcome to Falling by the Wayside. In this podcast, we'll be covering an old building on the University of New England's Biddeford campus. Through archaeological digs and archival research, 18 students uncovered a modern mystery right on our own campus. Come on a journey with us and learn about the indigenous people of southern Maine, murdered pet crows, shore dinner halls, family drama, and one very peculiar house. In this episode, we'll touch on the early history of Biddeford and how the people shaped the town we have all grown to know today. Before there were people on this land, there was ice. Imagine. Ice as far as the eye can see. In some places, up to a mile thick. A massive glacier, covering what is now the northern United States and Canada.
Everybody that was here that came to North America or South America came by way of Asia, the originals. And that was because of the land bridge at the Bering Sea.
That is Paul McDonough, president of the Biddeford Historical Society and teacher of sociology at the York County Senior and Community Colleges.
The surface of that ice field was probably around 20,000 feet thick. It was this monstrous thing that just built up, and so forth. And then eventually the planet started to warm.
There was a specific group of people who settled in what is now southern Maine. Dr. Arthur Anderson from the University of New England tells us.
For a lot of folks in Maine, if there's kind of one piece about the prehistoric archaeology of Maine, they've heard of its Wabanaki ancestors who have been here for 12, 13, 14, 15,000 years, as often said, really since time immemorial.
But that doesn't even scratch the surface. Samuel Champlain, Frenchman, explorer, and cartographer.
What Champlain seems to record as the Alamushiqui are related to Wabanaki people of the northeastern United States, and identity is always a fluid thing.
Thanks to Champlain and his recording skills, both in journal form and map form, we have a lot of information about his experiences with the Amichiqua people and the land itself. So, Champlain's 1605 map is super interesting.
Yeah,
a lot of details on it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's very detail-oriented.
There was depictions of the wigwams and different
crops,
and yeah, like, I think islands too, and fishing.
Yeah, and one of the things that's really significant to me is the shape of the river itself is not the same as what it used to be. If you look out to the Saco River now in the mouth here, we'll see the jetty is stones that were put in place to widen the Saco River to get the mouth open so ships could easily navigate in and out regardless of tides. Back in Champlain's day, there's a sandbar that actually kind of came out, and there was a river delta that at low tide, terrible to navigate. To try to get your ship into the river, a real hassle, dangerous, you could run your ship aground.
Another good point about that is that because of this jetty that's been put in by the Army Reserve, we've had a lot of degradation in our soil. Erosion, I think, is a better word, probably. We've had a lot of erosion of our banks, so it would make sense that the riverbed does look a little bit different from back in Champlain's day.
It's interesting to see how much it's actually changed from 1605 to 2024.
Yeah.
I think another good point is, Lucas, you grew up in this area.
Yeah.
Is
Biddeford born and raised?
Hometown.
Yeah.
Would you say that growing up in this area, you had 100% already seen this map before?
No, definitely not. It wasn't until I was really looking into the history of this area, probably during my time at Southern Maine Community College, that I was really thinking about history at all. And the colonizers that came here, the idea that Native Americans had been here previously, it's extremely loaded. And we don't know enough about their history. They didn't have a written history or anything. Most of it was, their history was through oral traditions, legends, and myths, and so much more that I don't have a clue about.
And I know
it's fascinating.
Arthur is doing a lot to help uncover that, Dr. Arthur Anderson. He does a lot with the archaeology of the Native people. Thanks to Champlain and other records, we know that the Amichiqua people, and also the Wabanaki, fished and ate both salmon and sturgeon. We also know that they ate clams, because we have archaeological evidence, uncovered by UNE's own Dr. Arthur Anderson, who we have heard from earlier.
These people were maritime people. They depended upon the coastline and the rivers that flowed into them.
Do you know how big an Atlantic sturgeon can grow?
Big. Up to 17 feet. As somebody, I study fish. It's big.
Those things are gigantic. I've never swam in the Saco. Saco?
Saco.
but I'm never going to. Ever. I'm scared.
I will say, sturgeons aren't going to get that big in the Saco now. They're a lot smaller and very rare due to a lot of pollution and nutrient runoff into the river. It's just not realistic to sustain fish that big. But during the time that the Amachiquas was there, it was definitely realistic for these things to be up to 17 feet long. Huge, massive, strong fish. Not as much of a threat to people eating food-wise, but jumping out of the river, they can cause some damage.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in a canoe?
Yeah. And hunting them? Who in their right mind is going to go and see a 17-foot fish out in the river and go, yeah, I want to get out there in my canoe and stab a spear through its head so I can have a meal? I don't know. I'm not built that way, but...
Me either. Not built that
way. No, not personally. Lots of meat, though.
Yeah, it would feed a lot of people.
Lots of meat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hear their eggs are very, very sought after.
Are they really?
Yeah, sturgeon eggs. Oh. Sturgeon caviar.
Oh,
they're largely they're very largely aquacultured for their eggs. Yeah.
Neat.
Huge market. Caviar, sturgeon eggs, the more expensive kind.
Oh.
Also endangered because of it, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Amachiqua must have been eating very well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Clam, sturgeon.
Good point. Clam,
got it.
Caviar. Seafood, of course, is not the only thing that they ate.
There's actually a lot of records from Champlain at the time. There used to be a lot of wild grapes in the area. There's the Isle of Bacchus that's really close to UNE here. And that, as well as a lot of... Do you guys know, like, root beer?
I love root beer.
The root of root beer actually comes from this tree. Do we know the name of it?
I don't.
Sassafras.
Sassafras.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I should have known the name of that.
People used to chew on the bark for flavor, and the root of that is the namesake of root beer. Not anymore, though. We're not getting pure extract from that. Known carcinogen now.
Oh!
Here.
You know, I feel very connected to the indigenous people now because I grew up on root beer.
In Champlain's map, we also see, right over where UNE is now, wigwams.
You go and hear about Native American housing and... Maybe you think of, like, teepees, but not what was really out here in southern Maine. We had these structures that they made that I've seen a photograph, and I still think they're unreal. Just saplings that are, like, maybe an inch in diameter, or maybe not even that thick, but they seem so structurally sound. They're just bent, and they form these little domes that between them are also saplings and wood. It's magic to me how they're able to go and form these, but they were hardy wood structures that were just little domes with entrances, and they seemed effective. I'd love to see one in person. Where are the wigwams at? I don't know.
I don't know about you guys, but when I see a picture of a wigwam, I kind of think of a wooden igloo. Because it kind of looks like it.
It's like kind of accurate. It's not really built brick-wise, but it's a dome with an entrance.
Igloo.
Basket igloo. Yeah? You know, sure. I can't say I'm too closely knowledgeable on, like, igloos or wigwams, but it's accurate enough to me.
And definitely cool and amazing structures, either way. That I would not be able to construct that without modern technology.
Nope.
Even with modern technology, no way. I don't think I can do it.
I do not have the building skills for that.
I'll play with my Legos, thank you very much.
Champlain left, however, and once the French got back on their boat, the English sailed in. Specifically, an Englishman named Richard Vines, who was sent on, let's say, a land-claiming mission.
So, local boy.
Yeah, what's up?
You ever heard of Richard Vines?
No, not really.
He's technically called, like, the founder of Biddeford, and that his birthplace, way back in Devonshire, England, was named Biddeford.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's like he is the namesake of Biddeford? He's the reason why it's named Biddeford?
Yeah, would seem so. I mean, it's kind of funny. They, like, didn't even try to come up with new names. They were just like, oh, yes, let's just pick this one and put it over here.
It's so common. Driving through New England, you just see New Lebanon always cracks me up. My family's Lebanese. I drive through New Lebanon. I'm like, oh. I always wonder if they have the food over there, too. Like, was there a large is there a large population of Lebanese people? I want grape leaves.
Yeah.
Can I have kibbeh, please? Please. The winter of 1616 was when tragedy struck.
What was happening to the Amichiqua was they had contracted European diseases, measles, common cold, and it was killing them. Then Vine said in his journals that although they were dying, they did no harm to any Englishman.
There hath, by God's visitation, rained a wonderful plague that resulted in the utter destruction, devastation, and depopulation of that whole territory. So there is not left any that do claim or challenge any kind of interest therein. We, in our judgment, are persuaded and satisfied that the appointed time is come in which Almighty God, in his great goodness and bounty towards us and our people, hath thought fit and determined that those large and goodly territories, deserted as it were by their natural inhabitants, should be possessed and enjoyed by such of our subjects. King James the First.
This rapid and deadly spread of disease was known as the Great Dying. From 1616 to 1619, around 70% of the native population died from disease brought over from the English colonists. This, of course, was seen by the English as a sign from God that they were destined to conquer this land, completely disregarding the massive loss of life and culture.
In the Great Migration, so in the 1630s, tens of thousands of colonists are coming over in that period. They would initially start in the area that is Boston or Salem today. Those towns quickly became overpopulated. People wanted land to farm, and so the next best place to go is people headed west. I am Dr. Elizabeth DeWolf. I am professor of history here at UNE. Then after you're going west, colonists started to head north. And the coastal regions are settled first. So coastal New Hampshire and then up into Maine. And again, people were traveling on the coast. They were traveling by boat. That was the fastest way to get from here to Boston. And then, of course, people are settling around rivers because if you're going to go inland for fish or other products, you're going to go on the river. You're not going to hack through the forest. So that is why we have these settlement patterns in Maine the way we do.
And then the burning of 1675 came to Biddeford.
When Biddeford Winter Harbor was first settled, relationships with the indigenous populations were quite peaceful and mutually beneficial. But that changed as the population of European colonists grew. That put more pressure on the land. It put more pressure on the ecosystem. And settler colonial habits were infringing on indigenous practices, and that led to stress and strife, which eventually, New England-wide, would turn into warfare, King Philip's War, and then later the French and Indian War. And it was it got quite dangerous for settlers. There were attacks, houses were burned down, individuals were taken, and the usual practice was to march captives to French Canada, and then they would be ransomed back to English colonial powers. So it was frightening. This was the frontier. Colonists called, you know, the New England area a howling wilderness, and there was plenty to fear. And at that point in time, the indigenous populations were one of those fears. at various points in time, Falmouth, which is now Portland, was attacked. Wells was burned to the ground. This was a dangerous period, and so colonists were feeling incredibly isolated, cut off from military garrisons, distant from colonial governors, who were all the way down in Boston, and for their safety, they headed south.
Through 1675 to 1715, Biddeford burned, and the land was rarely safe enough for anyone, native or colonizer. Be it through the fires or through disease, Biddeford was left largely unpopulated for around 40 years. How could this have happened? According to Legends and Myths of Old Biddeford Part 1, we see the beginning of a potential shifting point, at least culturally, if not factually, with the story of the curse of the Saco River. It goes like this.
In 1675, several sailors from vessels in the river near Cow Island were crossing in a small boat and passed a canoe containing the infant son of a famous Squanto, chief of the Secaucus, hitherto a warm friend of the whites. For a thoughtless and cruel joke, a sailor seized the little one and tossed it into the water, declaring that papooses, like puppies, could swim from birth. The child sank, and the poor mother sprang overboard and, diving, saved it and brought it to shore. But it died soon after. Never forgave this terrible insult, and the uneasiness among his tribesmen caused by the King Philip's War in Massachusetts and Rhode Island was simply magnified by this incident, and a bloody Indian uprising followed.
I remember hearing about the curse of the Saco River probably like at 8 years old from my mom, just kind of near Factory Island. We were riding across the bridge there, and some boy had drowned recently. It was just like the curse of the Saco River claims another. And just like young boys kind of historically have like drowned in the river, and it's become a bit of a folklore curse.
It's interesting to see how those stories have continued to carry over orally from the people that have lived in Biddeford. Still to this day, residents know about the happenings on the Saco with Squanto and his child.
Yeah, it's a really famous story in the area.
It definitely is feasible that this is some real story that's probably, I'm sure, been changed in some way from the original story. But that's the thing with a lot of these legends and folklore tales, is there is usually a grain of truth in there somewhere. Something that happened before.
In this case, a very, very sad grain.
Yes, definitely a very sad story that portrayed a lot of violence against the native populations at the time, mm-hmm. which was really relevant. They weren't seen, I mean, completely as human. I mean, you can hear it even in the retelling of the story. And while they're definitely not painting the natives to be the villain in this story, it's just still that undertone of kind of discrimination that yeah. you're left with.
There's a tone of supremacy that comes with a lot of these historical records, whether it's cultural, technological, the settlers, at least some of them, kind of looked down on the natives, and it was a point of contention, to say the least.
I mean, even when you think about what Factory Island is today and what it used to be to native people, like, they went up there for salmon, and then all of the settlers came and were like, oh, this would be a great place to put a factory.
Then once warfare either ended or moved to a different area, people pushed right back in.
One of the notable mills, called Royal Saw, was an ironworks factory on Colonel Cutts Island, which was built in 1811. The factory produced nearly 3,500 pounds of nails per day. The sale of the factory in 1821 marked a turning point in the course of Biddeford's industry, with the more widespread use of the falls for industrial purposes and the shifting of the center of town from Biddeford Pool area up to around where downtown is located today.
Samuel Batchelder had observed factories in the Boston area and realized that the Saco River with the falls presented an ideal location for the Industrial Revolution occurring in New England. Producing your goods is step one. Transporting your goods is step two.
I think it's really, really neat that one of these mills was producing that many nails, and that we might have been digging up these very nails from the ground over and over again.
I don't know about you guys, but that's one of my favorite parts of the dig, was coming up with a nail. I was always so excited for the nails. It was one of my favorite artifacts that we found.
There was bags
full of bags of nails.
And I mean a wide variety of time periods too. The history of Biddeford is culturally very rich and depicts a history centered around the Saco River and the resources it provides. Be it power to an ironworks mill, or the mills that followed, the use of it for transportation, or for food supplies, or even the placement of our house, the wayside, and the eventual placement of our college. Water and the Saco River are integral to the history of Biddeford and shape the environment that the wayside and the people living in it would later experience. Next time on Falling by the Wayside, exploration of the shore dinner halls and the tourism that this area of Biddeford would now draw post-industrial shift. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on
Falling by the Wayside.